This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself. And no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who, has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that he might try you by what he has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and he is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran is calling for a UN resolution to condemn those behind the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Israeli jets bomb locations across the Gaza Strip amid heightened tensions in the Palestinian territories. The number of coronavirus cases in Europe reaches 100 million as Omicron infections soar across the continent. Welcome to the program. Iran calls on the UN to adopt a resolution condemning those behind the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The Iranian President's office has made the call in a letter to the President of the UN General Assembly. The letter says the impunity granted to the perpetrators of the drone strike poses a threat to international peace and security. It stresses that attacks on government and diplomatic officials are crimes against humanity and violate the UN Charter and international law on human rights. It warns that inaction on state terrorism can lead to devastating consequences for the international community. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the latest Israeli airstrikes that targeted several locations across the Gaza Strip. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem says the air raids are another act of aggression by Tel Aviv against Palestinians and that the resistance front will keep defending the Palestinian people until the occupied territories are liberated. According to the official, the air defense units of resistance forces will confront the enemy warplanes. Israeli jet fighters targeted a Hamas training center in the town of Khan Yunis in western Gaza Strip overnight. They also struck Hamas security posts as well as training centers of the Islamic Jihad movement in the north of the coastal territory. Four Yemeni civilians have been killed and several others injured in Saudi Arabia's latest airstrikes against its southern neighbor. The casualties occurred in Ar-Ragu area in the northwestern province of Sa'da. Saudi warplanes also pounded several other Yemeni provinces, including Ma'rib and Shabwa. Human rights groups say nearly 390 Yemenis have been killed in Saudi airstrikes, or I should say strikes, in 2021 alone. The report says over 1,400 people have also been injured in the attacks. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have fallen victim to the onslaught Riyadh launched on their country in 2015. The ongoing war and its consequences have resulted in what the UN has called the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. All right, on the story that I earlier read for you, on the fact that Iran has called on the UN to adopt a resolution to condemn those behind the assassination of its fallen paramount soldier, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. I'm going to bring in Mr. Barry Grossman. He's an international lawyer who joins us via Skype out of the island of Bali. Mr. Grossman, as always, it's good to have you with us on the show. You're such a great contributor to our shows. Tell me your understanding of this. Obviously, Iran has the right, you know, for some kind of justice when it comes to somebody as large or anyone for that matter, you know, any one of its citizens let alone, you know, somebody as great as, you know, General Soleimani. But how do you react to that? Of course, it's Iran's right, but how do you think this is going to be perceived as far as the UN especially is concerned?
Well, let me first of all respectfully correct you. No one has the right to anything anymore. We're well past the era of where we pretended to have something called equality before the law. And the United Nations itself, especially when it comes to the Security Council, isn't concerned with justice. It's concerned with maintaining security and the Western, that is, Atlantic world sense of security at that. So the notion that many people hold or embrace that somehow individuals and nations are entitled to justice is a very nice one, but unfortunately there's not really any institutions left that are in the business of dispensing justice. As for the call itself, I mean, one would think this is a very non-controversial request, that is, to denounce this state-sponsored act of terrorism, but of course it's not going to happen. The simple fact of the matter is that General Soleimani was in Iraq at the time on a diplomatic mission. He was murdered, he was assassinated in a combined effort sponsored by, even carried out by the United States with Israeli support, and they murdered him. And there's no way to paint a different face on that picture, that blood-stained picture. And of course, his passing is something, in a sense, we can celebrate because clearly he has been martyred, and his family can look forward to him earning all of the benefits and entitlements that go with martyrdom in the afterlife. But sometimes that doesn't do a lot to ease the pain that individuals endure, that is, the surviving members of the family. But there's really no room to take issue with the Iranian call that the United Nations denounce this state-sponsored act of terrorism. But quite frankly, the chances of it happening are, I think, almost zero.
Mm-hmm. That really, I mean, coming from you, Barry, really breaks my heart to hear that, you know, the fact of the matter, the fact on the ground these days is that, you know, you can't really ask for justice when it comes to matters like this, you know, even when it comes to your own citizens and like that. That's such a grim picture. But tell me, doesn't that, I mean, obviously, I know the answer to that. It sends a very bad signal if you come with impunity. You terrorize a nation, and then you you kill some people, and then you go without punishment. What kind of an example does that really set?
Well, that's a very good question, and certainly I've been personally arguing that ever since 9/11, certainly even beforehand, but it became very clear in the aftermath of 9/11. That the United States' attitude when it comes to international relations is you're either with us or against us, and if you're with us, we can do whatever we want. We're not subject to any law. We're far too exceptional to be held to account. And that's the message that the U.S. establishment is beaming out to all of those disenfranchised people in the United States itself, as well as the wider Atlantic world. As for everyone else, of course, the message they're beaming out is even more gruesome. But if we stick for a moment with the message that is being sent out to those people in the United States itself that are in many respects disenfranchised, obviously this engenders in people this notion that as long as they're big enough and bad enough, they don't have to follow the law. So it shouldn't be any surprise that we see, if not an upsurge in crime itself, certainly an upsurge in violence being meted out by the security apparatus to deal with people perceived as potentially being criminals. And we see an entire lost generation who feel that the only way to move forward, to get ahead in this world, is to have power, the kind of power that comes with being connected and having money. And if you have that power, the rules don't apply. You can get away with doing anything you want. And we see that on a daily basis. There was a time, not so many years ago, where the entire world at least pretended to be concerned with waging a war on corruption, where treaties were enacted to criminalize paying bribes to foreign public officials. But of course, none of that has been enforced, like so much law that's passed in the form of international treaties. It all sounds good on paper, but there's really very little political will or commitment to enforcing those laws back where it matters, that is, in the countries that are putting tourists to them. And so the message that's been going out loud and clear for a very long time is, if you're big enough and bad enough, you don't have to follow the rules.
That's so sad, but yet very eye-opening. Many, many thanks, as always. Honorable Barry Grossman, he's an international lawyer who joined us via Skype out of Bali. Thank you very much. Have a very good afternoon in Bali, sir. South Africa holds a state funeral for anti-apartheid icon Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Mr. Tutu died last Sunday at the age of 90, triggering grief at home and abroad for a life spent fighting injustice. President Cyril Ramaphosa accorded Tutu the official funeral usually reserved for presidents. He described the ceremony as a Category 1 funeral with religious characteristics. Ramaphosa lauded the late Nobel Peace Prize laureate as a moral compass and national conscience.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu was without question a crusader in the struggle for freedom, for justice, for equality, and for peace, not only in South Africa, the country of his birth, but around the world as well.
Ramaphosa acclaimed the human rights pioneer as the, quote, spiritual father of their new nation. Famous for his modesty, Tutu gave instructions for a simple ceremony with a cheap coffin and donations for charity instead of floral tributes, followed by an eco-friendly cremation. The South African icon is recognized as a revered leader in the struggle against the country's apartheid regime in the 1980s. Another grim milestone for Europe in its fight against the pandemic. The continent's overall COVID infections are now over 100 million. The figure accounts for more than one-third of COVID cases recorded worldwide over the past 2 years. Nearly 5 million of the European infections are registered in the last week alone. Of those cases, more than 1 million were detected in France. Europe has been a hotspot of infections in recent weeks. The more virulent Omicron variant is taking part of the blame. Despite the uptick, COVID-related deaths are decreasing in Europe. The daily average over the past week was more than 3,400. That's a 7% drop from the previous week. Now, disruptions to global air travel continue, with thousands of flights being canceled or delayed worldwide. Tracking website FlightAware says some 4,700 flights were canceled worldwide on Saturday, 2,700 of them in the United States alone. A total of over 11,000 others were delayed, with the U.S. accounting for 6,000 of them. Many pilots, flight attendants, and other staff are absent from work either because they contracted COVID or are in quarantine. Bad weather is also causing some disruptions in the U.S., with snowstorms particularly hitting airports in Chicago. And finally, for Iran, 2021 was a year of transitions in both politics and foreign policy. The country also witnessed the deadly outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic. This report takes a close look at some of the major occurrences in Iran in the past year. Let's watch it.
In 2021 saw a new administration take office in Iran, and new rounds of negotiations to revive the 2015 deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran also witnessed a breakout of the novel coronavirus in 2021, and a belated vaccination rollout, using both domestically produced and imported vaccines, dramatically reduced the fatalities by the year's end. We are going to take a closer look at the major events that took place in Iran in 2021. The signatories to the 2015 agreement, which called for the removal of sanctions on Iran in exchange for some nuclear curbs, came together in April to revive the accord. The United States was, of course, not directly taking part in the talks, with Iran as it unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018. The negotiations started during the last year of former Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's administration. This came after the new administration in the White House publicly announced Washington's readiness to rejoin the JCPOA if Iran returned to full compliance with the deal. And there was the core of disagreement between the two sides. After the US withdrawal, Iran waited for a full year to see how the European sides will make amends for Washington's move. But after seeing no sign of meaningful action, Tehran started to gradually roll back on its commitments under the deal. Iran said it was entitled to do so as per the terms of the agreement itself. For Iran, it was obvious that the ball was in the US court. Washington, however, insisted that it was in Iran's. The sixth round of talks in Vienna failed to yield an agreement to revive the deal. The talks eventually came to a grind in March ahead of Iran's presidential election. Iranians went to the polls in June and elected Ebrahim Raisi as their next president. The former head of the judiciary won a landslide victory with 62% of the votes, raking in 18 million out of the 28 million ballots cast. In his first press conference, Raisi had this to say about the prospect of a meeting with the US president under his watch. Raisi also said Iran would prioritize relations with its neighbors. Soon after he took office, Tehran joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which could significantly boost Iran's trade ties with Russia, China, and other members of the bloc. Back in March, Iran signed a 25-year strategic partnership with China, which would see Beijing investing up to $400 billion in the country's economy. Iran's new foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, also chose Damascus for his first bilateral foreign visit. The trip meant that Iran would put its partners first. Tehran continued its support for its allies, including resistance groups in Palestine, as well as Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah. With the new administration in charge, Iran also saw a dramatic boost to its vaccination campaign in 2021. Iran's COVID-related fatalities and cases hit new highs in August as the country reported a record daily toll of more than 700 to become the worst-hit nation in West Asia. Under its new administration, Iran began importing huge amounts of foreign vaccines while introducing its own homegrown jabs. This was achieved in the face of tough US sanctions.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
vacation on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
More Afghan people may die from U.S. sanctions against their country. The ongoing famine crisis and the destruction of what remains of the Afghan economy could result in the death of millions of people, says Li Pang, writer, in an article published under the heading "Humanitarian exemptions to crushing U.S. sanctions do little to prevent collapse of Afghanistan's economy." Stay tuned for more. When the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan in August, ceding to the Taliban, the country's economy began a severe contraction, what the Financial Times calls one of the worst economic meltdowns in history. The sprawling crisis has left nearly 23 million people in extreme hunger, and at least 1 million children under the age of 5 are now facing the immediate threat of starvation, according to the United Nations. As commerce ground to a halt, food and fuel prices skyrocketed in large part due to economic sanctions placed on the Taliban by the U.S. regime. As many as 300,000 Afghans have fled to neighboring Pakistan, and many more refugees may soon leave the country. The Biden administration defends the sanctions by pointing to a series of exemptions designed to allow humanitarian aid. The Treasury Department has touted its role as a leading humanitarian donor to the people of Afghanistan and its work to ensure that funds flow through legitimate and transparent channels via official sanction exemption licenses. But those humanitarian exemptions, overseen by the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, are nowhere near enough. According to experts who spoke to The Intercept, the OFAC licenses, including new licenses released on December 22, 2021, have not curbed the global chilling effect of the sanctions and are ineffective in preventing a spiraling disaster that could kill more Afghan people than nearly 20 years of U.S.-backed war and occupation. Businesses and individuals that violate U.S. sanctions on the Taliban risk steep fines and criminal penalties. The broad sanctions imposed by the U.S. lack specificity and raise the possibility that routine commercial activities in Afghanistan could fall under sanctions policy. None of these OFAC licenses, none of them address the issue of international banks in their dealing with Afghan banks, hesitancy to deal with Afghan taxes, banking transactions for commercial imports, said Shah Mehrabi, a member of Afghanistan's Central Bank Board, adding, the sanctions have created a lot of fear in the minds of those who do not want to go ahead and engage in taking this particular risk. OFAC has issued licenses for medicine, remittances, education, salaries, and other forms of humanitarian assistance. Additional licenses released recently allow exemptions for education funds and expand the scope of U.S. funds to aid organizations in Afghanistan. Mehrabi, who teaches economy at Montgomery College in Maryland, noted that much of Afghanistan's domestic economy faces impending failure, a problem that cannot be solved by merely allowing humanitarian aid to flow. The U.S. Treasury Department added Mehrabi has focused on piecemeal humanitarian exemptions and has not addressed the central issue of how Afghanistan can import and export goods, collect taxes, and pay salaries. Mehrabi said, we are talking about an economy that's going to collapse if Treasury does not clarify what could be done to the liquidity issue. When the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan in August 2021, U.S. sanctions imposed since 2002 that criminalize any form of support for the Taliban as a specially designated global terrorist group suddenly meant that penalties could apply to leaders of a sovereign state. As U.S. forces withdrew, American law firms quickly alerted international institutions across the globe that any business transaction in Afghanistan could risk violating sanctions. Any routine tax payment or duty paid to an Afghan bureaucrat could be construed as aiding and abetting the Taliban. Even if the Treasury Secretary does not specifically designate the entire government of Afghanistan, it will be very difficult for contractors and grantees to know whether a standard transaction with the government of Afghanistan, such as paying taxes, permit fees, utility fees, import duties, or other routine payments, will result in funds passing to the Taliban or its leaders in control of various branches of the Afghan government, noted a client alert from the law firm Nicholas Liu. Contractors and businesses, the firm noted, can expect banks to de-risk from Afghanistan, meaning that fund transfers to or from Afghanistan will be intercepted by intermediary banks and blocked until the contractor or grantee can demonstrate that the specific transfer to and the use of funds in Afghanistan will comply with U.S. sanctions. The banking industry is reading the sanctions as the entire government is now the Taliban, a former U.S. Treasury Department official told the crisis group. The far-reaching sanctions, along with a Biden administration decision to freeze nearly $10 billion of Afghanistan's central bank national reserves, sent the economy into free fall. Payments to doctors and police stopped. Hospitals ran out of medicine. Residents could not withdraw bank deposits. Even a printing press in Poland contracted to print Afghanis. The local currency could not deliver its shipment. Rajiv Agrawal, the chief financial officer of KEC International, an Indian firm tapped to build electric utility transmission lines in Afghanistan, told investors in October that its five projects in the country suddenly ceased payments in August. Agrawal reported the U.S. has choked all the funding lines to Afghanistan. Sanctions are intended to have a chilling effect in that sanctions will always go beyond the face of the text, said Adam Weinstein, a research fellow with the Queen's Institute for Responsible Spacecraft. No bank or business wants to walk right up to the line when it comes to compliance with U.S. sanctions policy, given that these are risk-averse institutions. Recently, 40 members of the House of Representatives wrote to President Joe Biden, urging him to cease sanctions and release Afghanistan central bank funds controlled by the U.S. regime. No increase in food and medical aid can compensate for the macroeconomic harm of soaring prices of basic commodities, a banking collapse, a balance of payments crisis, a freeze on civil servant salaries, and other severe consequences that are rippling throughout Afghan society, harming the most vulnerable, noted the letter, led by Representatives Pramila Jayapal, Sarah Jacobs, and Jesus G. Choi Garcia. There is little appetite among politicians in Washington, D.C. to radically reverse course. The Biden administration facing low public approval ratings following the exit from Afghanistan and a tough forecast for the 2022 midterm elections may be continuing sanctions for political reasons. Releasing the sanctions could be viewed as recognition of the Taliban as the legitimate rulers of Afghanistan, a symbolism that could cement negative attitudes about the administration and its Afghanistan policy. Senate Republicans led by Senator Mitt Romney, Utah, and Senator Jim Risch, Idaho, have released demands that the administration go even further in sanctioning the Taliban, including any foreign governments that provide support to Afghanistan. Earlier this month, The Intercept attempt to speak to a number of senators, Democrats and Republicans, about U.S. sanctions fueling widespread famine in Afghanistan. Many refused to talk about the issue.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome to The Shaheed, a show that aims to unravel the different dimensions of Qasem Soleimani's personality as well as his activities. I'm Sarbazul Rizvi, and in this episode, we'll be talking about Syria, from where Qasem Soleimani embarked on the journey that led to his martyrdom. As per some reports, the Israeli regime tracked him down at the Damascus airport and got him martyred at the Baghdad airport in collusion with the Americans. The decade-long war in Syria has attracted widespread attention of the masses more than any other international event and has left over 500,000 people dead and millions homeless. Many portrayed Qasem Soleimani as a bestial figure in the Syrian crisis and blamed him for this gruesome war. But Syria stood its ground, and today hardly anyone denies the fact that it was him who saved Syria from turning into another Libya, a torn, battered, and unoccupied country. Let's have a look at the role he played in the crisis of Syria and how he turned the tables on the Western and Saudi-backed terrorists in the region who wanted to disintegrate the Syrian nation. A prominent Australian academic and activist, a senior lecturer of the University of Sydney, and author of several books and articles criticizing imperialism. Dr. Tim Anderson, thank you for accepting our invitation.
You're welcome.
If I'm not wrong, you are currently at Damascus, the Syrian capital. Tell us, what does exactly Syria stand today in ending 2021, starting 2022?
Well, Syria is on the verge of defeating the war, the terrorist war. It only exists in safe havens where there are the occupations of the two major NATO armies of Turkey and the USA and of Israel in the south. So on that, because of that, really, there is an opening, particularly from regional states, notably the Emiratis, Jordan. There's an opening where there had not been openings for some time. Nevertheless, there is a terrible economic war still going on, of course, driven by Washington out of spite for losing this war.
Recently, we have heard about new events taking place. Even the Gulf countries or Persian Gulf countries are taking, you know, different attitudes. It seems at least that they are taking different attitudes. Among them was the trip of the foreign ministry of UAE. How do you analyze and how do you, you know, interpret those events?
Yes, well, that's one of several openings that are going on here at the moment. In the case of the Emiratis, it's significant that they reopened their embassy back in late 2018, along with, I think, Bahrain at the time, because they saw the course of directions were going, that the Damascus government was holding firm. They'd resisted all the pressures from the outside. And, of course, in retaliation for that, the former President Trump effectively blackmailed the UAE into recognizing Israel, the so-called Abraham Accords. So there was a cost for that to the Emiratis. But nevertheless, the Emiratis have pursued their course. They want to re-establish relations. They have a number of investment projects. They don't want to lose their relevance and influence in the region. That's what it comes down to. And you could say something similar about Jordan in the south, that Jordan was keen to reopen as soon as the opportunity came along.
And it seems likely that Syria is going to take part in the upcoming Arab summit in Algeria.
Well, that may or may not be the case. To my mind, the Arab League is significantly tainted by having turned against two of the most important members, Libya and Syria, a decade ago. It came to be dominated by the Gulf monarchies, notably Saudi Arabia. And so whether or not Syria joins, I suspect that organization is running up to its expiry date.
There are different factors related to the Syrian crisis, but our concentration in this program is on the Major General Qasem Soleimani, martyred General Qasem Soleimani. How do you analyze his role in defending Syria and in reaching to what we are today? At least we are, in a much more better condition towards what we are in 2013, 14, 15. How do you analyze the role of General Qasem Soleimani in Syria?
The life of the late Qasem Soleimani in Syria was extraordinary. Of course, we know that he had a very important role in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Iraq, as well as in Syria, as well as in Iran, of course. I remember most closely the involvement of Soleimani in the battles in the Lebanon mountains, the Kalamun mountains. He played a very important role in the along the Euphrates River, the liberation of Deir ez-Zor, and pushing immediately after the liberation of Deir ez-Zor from ISIS down to the border crossing, which is still controlled by the Axis countries, by the resistance countries. And that's become a focus of conflict in recent times because, as you know, the US occupation in Iraq and Syria has placed itself all along those borders from the northeast down to the south in Al-Tamah, the closest connection between Baghdad and Damascus. And the only exception is that crossing at Al-Hukamal between Syria and Iraq. And recently there was exposure of a US massacre close by to that too. So it was Qasem Soleimani that took the decision to move very quickly from Deir ez-Zor and secure that crossing. And I think that's fitting because what we most remember him for, I think, is not simply as an Iranian general, but as a commander of the resistance across all of the independent states of the region.
Exactly, exactly. We will continue our discussion with Tim Anderson after a short, item. Stay with us.
The picture I paint of Soleimani in relation to Syria is how it's been put by the media. Actually, it's extracting a picture of the general from the context that is Syria. Syria is a country that has never experienced a stable official political order outside of single-party rule. In the 20 years between 1946, when France exited Syria for good, and 1966, when the Ba'ath coup d'etat occurred and a single-party system took control, Syria had never experienced a stable order. In those two decades, the country saw 8 coup d'etats. That's not all. In the same period, Syria's borders were moved. Of course, that was nothing new to Syria. The sum of all that passed gave way to Ba'ath party rule as an authority capable of restoring public order. In 1970, Hafez Assad, who was defense minister till then, pulled off Syria's last coup d'etat and seized power. A Ba'athist since 1946, he restored order and began filtering the system with the army and set to govern all political and cultural offices directly. It was easy to predict a power vacuum after Hafez Assad. Young Bashar Assad experienced 2 uprisings right from the start of his office. His rule even coincided with turning points such as the 33-day war of South Lebanon and 22-day war of Gaza. With the 22-day war, the Hamas office in Damascus turned into a center for international talks in defense of Gaza, which forced Tel Aviv into accepting a ceasefire with its head hanging. Practically, it was the end of the political life of Ehud Olmert, once Israeli prime minister. Finally, with 2011 came domino uprisings called the Arab Spring, beginning with Tunisia. As the spring moved south, it snowballed to cover most all Arab lands. In Syria, as if at war, both sides were demonstrating, both Assad supporters and opposers, the latter being mostly in marginal, poorer cities. Arab and Western governments that would not accept the pact between Damascus and the resistance seized the opportunity by arming opponents. As such, they bribed officials and military officers to part ways with the Syrian government, and they boycotted Syria, hence straining its economy. The Arab Spring was a chance, no less, for the West to slip its own fighters into the Arab world. Via spy agencies in Turkey and Saudi Arabia, the West transferred fighters from Libya to Syria. With Libya's Muammar Gaddafi out of the way, it was that much easier. By the final months of 2011, Syria was choking on the bulk of terror groups that had gotten in. So by end 2011, Syria no longer had a social uprising on its hands, but a proxy and international war. Now here's where we get closer to Soleimani's involvement. Al-Qaeda also got into Syria via its Iraq branch. And who better to deal with it than General Soleimani, with his knowledge and experience with Iraq? Without his assistance, Syria may have drowned in a dark age of never-ending civil wars, with multinational Takfiri terror groups massacring religious minorities and destroying Shia places of worship such as the Shrine of Saint Zainab, peace be upon her, granddaughters of the Prophet Muhammad. It was under such circumstances that Haj Qasem, the great commander of the resistance, stood by his old ally. Thanks to his skill and military knowledge, together with his strategic outlook and bravery, the final victory fell to the resistance in Syria's war. Some ask, what would be the fate of Syria had Soleimani not arrived? Well, Syria's domestic fights are enough to explain the situation. Then again, there's Daesh, a famous recent example of why West Asia needed Soleimani, and now the strategic foundation he laid for the region. Syria's nightmare enemy of 2014 to 2017 was Daesh, which was defeated basically by Soleimani and his resistance.
Let's continue our interview with Dr. Tim Anderson. Dr. Anderson, what would have been possibly the possible map of the region if someone like General Qasem Soleimani was not there in Syria?
Well, it's very difficult to say. It's said that his role extended to inviting the Russian air power into Syria, which was critically important, of course, back in late 2015 and turning the course of that war. But I think, in general, we are going to remember Soleimani as a resistance commander, and therefore our attention is drawn to the integration of the independent peoples, the independent states to the region, the building of an alliance of independent countries against the imperial powers that have tried to disintegrate the region, as one Iranian commentator said. So I think the beginnings of the integration, the military, the economic, the infrastructural integration of this region in many respects are on a foundation of the human relations created by General Soleimani.
Yeah, you mentioned something really important, the human relations that General Soleimani started at this region. But one important thing, do you think something like Libya was going to take place to Syria as well? What we observed about the case of Libya and the direct intervention of the NATO, and now a war-torn country totally. There is nothing known as Libya today.
Yes, I think that's true. There was a Libyan plan for Syria very soon after. And of course, one of the reasons for the failure of that plan was that the NATO powers exposed their hand very quickly, having said that they weren't going to directly intervene. They used that pretext of a no-fly zone to directly intervene and to destroy the state. As you pointed out, the state has been smashed. There is no political will there, which is really what they wanted. And when they tried that plan on Syria sometime later on, however, it was quite significant that two of the independent big powers in the Security Council, namely Russia and China, didn't fall for the same trick again. I think that was important. It was important that Syria had allies, Syria had friends. Iran was the first amongst those, but Russia and China began to play an important role. And of course, we shouldn't underestimate the fact that the Syrian people themselves backed their army. The army did not disintegrate. They defended the concept of a nation that they loved and wanted to defend and resist all of the incursions at terrible costs. But certainly because of that resistance primarily, and secondarily because of the friends and the alliance, Syria survived, where Libya was crushed.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, at the end, what was done was basically initially done by the Syrian people. And, you know, General Qasem Soleimani was as a friend to the Syrian nation and Syrian people. Besides this war, I mean, this gruesome war that was in Syria, another war was also going on at the media level. A war that was targeting the personality of General Qasem Soleimani, to target his personality and to ruin his face and what he was doing. Specifically in Western and Arab media, almost all the mainstream media was trying to target what General Qasem Soleimani was doing, specifically after 2013-14, when his role was much more revealed at the region. So how do you analyze that part of the story, that, you know, media campaign and media war that was going on against General Qasem Soleimani and the resistance movement, generally speaking?
Well, the resistance movement is one thing. I think General Soleimani, in many respects, was a low-profile person, wasn't he? He didn't do many public interviews until, I think, the last year of his life. There were some important interviews in 2019, but it was acknowledged generally that he was leading the fight against ISIS at that time, back in 2015, 16, 17. I think it's after his murder, the brutal and treacherous murder by President Trump, for which we should never forget or forgive, that the Western media started to try and rewrite history, to try and recreate this man in some sort of way. Indeed,
exactly.
I'm one of a number of people who were kicked off Western social media simply for mentioning his name and the name of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq. Those people are categorized in their death as dangerous individuals and people to be banned from Western social media. So it's extraordinary, really, in a sense that they still sense this great threat. I'm talking about the war media, what I call the war media or the colonial media. They sense this great threat and they classify Muhandis, they classify General Soleimani as dangerous people still in their death.
So how do you think we can confront this, battlefield?
Well, of course, we have to tell the truth, don't we? We have to write the histories of the peoples that are beginning to be written here in Syria, in other parts of the region. It's very important that the resistance peoples, the independent peoples, write their own histories with their friends and colleagues around the globe, because one advantage we have to admit that the imperial powers have is a very well integrated media system. They have very strong reinforcement mechanisms, and in many respects the resistance has been lacking. So there is a battle going on at that level, as you said, a type of a war, a media war for hearts and minds, if you like, a moral war, because in many respects the Western imperial powers now place great use on this idea of human rights and humanitarian arguments for their terrible, awful, bloody wars that they're carrying on against, I think, what is it, 9 wars in this region in the last 2 decades, for example. So there is a need for independent voices to be heard and for the resistance media to have a much stronger role.
Thank you, Dr. Tim Anderson, prominent Australian academic and activist. Thank you for joining our invitation and being with
very
us
welcome.
On this special episode of The Shaheed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was just talking to Dr. Tim Anderson, the prominent lecturer in the Syrian lecture of the University of Sydney and also author of several books against imperialism. We talked about the role that General Qasem Soleimani played in saving and protecting Syria from not becoming another Libya, of course. In the next and the following part of our program, we are going to talk about something maybe somehow unusual, about ethics in war. Talking about ethics at a battlefield such as Syria and other battlefields of the region is somehow, you know, unusual. But in the following part of our program, we are going to shed some light on another dimension of the personality of Shaheed General Qasem Soleimani. Stay with us.
Kill who you will. Kill as you will. This is the general strategy of warmongers, those who fight just to win, making war of aggression that much uglier. But with different rules, the bloody face of war can actually be a scene of human exaltation and bring about the best in people. Sticking to ethics in war will prevent using just any means to win. Here are examples of how far things can go in a war without ethics and chivalry, or in weakness. Civilians are targeted, even by dirty chemical bombs. Rape is all too often used as a weapon, at best, even child rape. It is mostly just because of the motto, all is well in war, and simply because of morally loose command and constituents. Now this is not to say the odd incident cannot occur in chaos, even with the best morals and checks in place. But given noble command and clean constituents, that is soldiers, a war can even turn into an epic. And Qasem Soleimani considered himself a soldier of the faith. So ethics of war will have been everything to him. Plenty has been said on the ethics of war in holy books or poems and philosophical writings. Qasem Soleimani was among human beings who followed these teachings to the best of their ability. In fact, many who know him say the secret to his success was following Islamic ethics, even with an enemy on the battlefield. It's noteworthy, a major reason why Soleimani stuck by his ethics in war is that he was influenced by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The general himself recalls his days with the Kerman IRGC branch as such. Soleimani is quoted to have said in summary, "We captured a thug in Sistan and Balochistan province, a big drug smuggler who'd martyred several of our men. We lured him in by invitation and locked him up. The leader said to release him, much to my surprise. The reason was the Shia principle that you cannot hurt someone you've invited as your guest, even if he has killed your father." Sardar Asad Beghi, a fellow compatriot, tells of Haj Qasem's unwavering morals in the middle of the Syrian war in relation to one of the highest-ranking figures of the Takfiri al-Nusra group. That would be a Sheikh Abdullah, the number two of Takfiri groups. "We uncovered his whereabouts between 12 midnight till 5 a.m. one day and awaited orders to destroy him by drone attack. General Soleimani happened to find out and disagreed when he learned the man's visit to the house was to accompany his wife in labor, because that would mean destroying also his family and innocent people." The school of thought Haj Qasem believed in simply wouldn't allow him to set aside his ethics, even in dealing with his biggest enemy. A gardener named his dog Donald after the US president to belittle Donald Trump. Soleimani stopped him, although the same president would have given the order to assassinate him.
In this episode, we talked about Syria. Only God knows what would have been the geopolitics of East Asia if Haj Qasem Soleimani, along with the Syrian nation government, hadn't stood fast. Goodbye.
The U.S. military is supposedly there to protect people. It does the opposite, said John Reich, a Seattle-based writer specializing in American bases in Okinawa. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading "Alarming levels of forever chemicals found in water near U.S. bases in Okinawa." Stay tuned for more. As the U.S. military continues construction of a controversial new base at Henoko Bay, Okinawa, the recent discovery of extreme levels of highly toxic forever chemicals in local waterways and groundwater has renewed long-standing opposition to the American occupation of large portions of the Japanese archipelago. The Asahi Shimbun reported recently that water quality checks near U.S. bases in Okinawa found alarming levels of perfluorooctane, sulfonic acid, that is PFOS, at